Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Chronic Fatigue and Burnout Recovery Podcast. Today we're going to be doing a listener Q&A, and I have some questions around increasing capacity and being with unpleasant sensations in the body. I have a question around how to deal with new symptoms and infections when you're already on this healing and health journey. I have some questions about unrefreshing sleep, looking at surgery preparation, and then a question about medications generally. So that's what we're going to cover in this episode today. But before we go into each of these questions in a little bit more detail, I thought I would just explain how I'm approaching the Q&As at this point in time. So many of you may know, if you're already following me on Instagram, that I do mostly a weekly Q&A in my Instagram stories. And I'm just really taking the questions that I'm getting asked on a weekly basis and picking out some of the ones that I want to expand on in more details. So if you have asked a question on my Instagram before, then I might be answering this question in more detail for you here today. I also sometimes get people message me and ask me questions, or sometimes I even get questions submitted through the website contact form. So there's lots of different ways in which questions find me. I should probably have a more organized process, but it is helpful to know what's on people's minds, what information is useful, where the gaps are, where there's misunderstandings or where things are unclear. And then I have this wonderful space where I can address them for you in more detail. So that's how we're going to go about answering questions for now moving forward. Just a reminder, if you haven't already left a review for the podcast, I'd really appreciate that so much. It helps more people to find this information. If you can leave a review on Spotify or on iTunes, that would be great. I think on Spotify, it's really easy. You just click the 5-star button. In iTunes, you can always leave a written review if you would like to. And perhaps you know someone who needs to hear this information. Maybe you can share a specific episode with someone you know or in a community that you're in if you think the information is helpful and valuable. Of course, if you don't, then there's no need to share. But let's dive straight into the episode today. We'll start with the question about capacity. Because these questions have been asked through Instagram stories, there's already like a very small character limit on the asking box. So some of the questions are very brief, but I will read them out just to kind of get a sense of what people have specifically asked. So what I'm going to talk about first as we talk about capacity is actually two questions that I've put together into one answer. There was a question which was just tips for increasing capacity. And then a further question was, how can we increase our capacity to be with sensations in the body instead of fleeing from them? And at this point in time, I'm just preparing for the next round of my Nurturing Resilience program. The program is due to start on the 11th of March. This episode will probably get published a little while after the start date. But in preparation for the next round, I always offer a free workshop to give people a better sense of what we're going to cover in the program, because it's this somatic work needs to be experienced more so than it needs to be cognitively understood, which makes it very difficult to promote and sell, so to speak, because people need to actually just get a feeling in their body for it, as opposed to anything I could write on a sales page. So I digress a little bit, but just to say I ran this free workshop. The replay should still be available by the time this podcast publishes. If not, then you can probably catch the next one, which will be towards the end of the summer. But in that workshop, I actually go through these, what I call the three vital components that are required when we're supporting our nervous systems. And these steps are, spoiler alert, we need to stabilize the nervous system, which is actually something I spoke about in the previous episode. So if you haven't already listened to the previous episode on stability, highly recommend that you do that. But then the second one is building resourcefulness and coherence in the system, which is ultimately safety. Then once we have stability and we have coherence and resourcefulness, then we can build capacity. And the really important thing about these three steps is they have to be done in order. So everybody wants capacity. Everybody wants to be able to do more, tolerate more, really just have the capacity to have the life that they want to live. If your chronic illness experience was anything like mine, it probably took away so much of your life, so many of the things that you enjoyed. And life gets very limited, and it's really because our capacity physically and through from a nervous system perspective is limited. So when we're looking at this idea of building capacity again, that's the end goal. That's what everybody wants. That is what all the hard work, blood, sweat, and tears is for. But it's like the end game. The end game is to achieve capacity. But we can't just go on our merry way and work on our capacity. There needs to be a process, and there needs to be a structure in terms of how we go about building capacity. So when we're talking about tips for increasing capacity, it really goes back to the foundations. The system, a system which has more capacity is a system which has more stability. And therefore the first step, or the first tip, shall we say, in building capacity is achieving stability. And that's stability from a nervous system perspective, because syndromal conditions are typically unstable systems. And also stability from a physiological perspective. We need to have blood sugar stability. We need to have stability in our day-to-day routines. We need to have stability in our light-dark cycles. We need to have a stable sleep pattern. We need to have a stable circadian rhythm. So when we're looking at expanding our capacity, many people want to run before they can walk, literally and figuratively. And it comes back to all the boring basic stuff that you need to do first, which is stabilize your system. Stabilize your system from a physical, physiological perspective, and stabilize your nervous system as well. Then once we have a system which is more stable, we can start to work on creating more safety and connection and coherence and resourcefulness in that system. And so just because a system is stabilized doesn't mean that it necessarily has a huge capacity for safety and for expansion. And therefore, what we want to create is a greater sense of safety, a greater sense of connection within the body, so that there is then capacity to expand. And this is quite difficult to talk about in a podcast. So just to kind of say here again, this is what I'm describing to you, the stabilizing, the building of the connection and safety, and then the growing of capacity. That's something I spent 12 weeks going through in the Nurturing Resilience program. So to give 10 or 15 minutes to it in a podcast is, you know, it's a very, very small drop in the ocean. But what I'd really like for you to understand is just the bigger picture concepts. So we build this connection, we build the sense of safety in the system. And then when the system is more stable and when it's feeling more safe, what we can then do is begin to build capacity by titrating stresses in our life. What does that mean? It means we add in small, tolerable amounts stresses. And that could be positive stress or, air quotes, negative stress. So positive stress could be something that's like exciting to do. That's when you finally get to go out and do some fun stuff. It's stressful, but it's also stressful in a positive way. Or it could be negative stress, which, you know, might be things which are a little bit more like challenging. Like, for example, you may need to deal with certain things in your relationships, or you may need to deal with logistics with going back to work or managing finances. You know, there's a lot of things that we don't necessarily think of as positive, although they may have positive long-term consequences. But the kind of day-to-day stuff we've taken off our plate as part of the healing journey. Now we're gently, slowly putting that stuff back on our plate again. We can also think of hormetic stresses as well. So things like heat stress, cold stress, fasting, exercise, increasing the intensity of your exercise. Those are also potentially positive stresses that help us to grow our capacity over time. But the key thing here is the word titration. And titration, I did a biochemistry degree, and we used to, you know, do like, we used to get, you know, pipette, and then you would just do like drop things in like tiny little amounts into a solution really, really slowly. So there was a titrated dose. And that's kind of how you want to think of it in terms of your life. You're not suddenly taking on a whole bunch of stuff at once. It's just a little drop, a little dose, and then you see how the body responds. You give it time to integrate and settle again, allow for the expansion to happen, settle into the new sense of expansion, and then you add in the next little drop and dose. So we build our capacity over time through exposure to stress. But when you're in the beginning stages of your journey and you haven't necessarily built up the stability and the coherence in the system, that stress is potentially going to be very destabilizing and send you backwards. So capacity is built on the steps that come before, the stabilization and the building of safety and coherence. And we do that from a nervous system perspective. We also do it from a physiological perspective. And then over time, gently, slowly, capacity grows. And if you do have what I would call more of a syndromal pattern in your system, it's also not linear. You know, it's we may move into spaces where we feel we have more capacity, and then sometimes things happen and then we go back to a smaller capacity again. Then there's like a little bit of reorganization and healing work that needs to be done, and then we come back to expansion again. And, you know, I see that in my own body, still in my journey. There are just some weeks where I feel I can do more and some weeks where I feel I can do less. The difference is, I would say, is that it's more of a feeling of I've reached my edge versus my body going into like an illness to tell me that I've reached my edge, which for me would be, you know, brain fog and pain and really bad headaches and needing to just be in bed and not being able to work. When I kind of move into a smaller capacity now, I can feel the capacity is smaller and I'm more gentle with myself, but I'm still operating functionally in my day, if that makes sense. So it is a journey. My system is a very sensitive system. I had a consultation with my therapist just Friday last week. And I said to her, I just feel like my system is getting more and more sensitive all the time. And she said, certain systems are just really sensitive. And the more that you connect with yourself, the more sensitive that you become. We want to build more connection so we have more capacity. But then as we build more connection, if you do have a highly sensitive system, and not everyone does, but I definitely do, there's also sometimes just a feeling that you feel so much more of life as well. And that can be quite overwhelming at times. And that makes the journey a lot more tricky. And I think one of the things that I've had to do, and now I'm going on a little bit of a tangent, but one of the things that I've had to do and I've had to realize is just become more accepting that I live in a very, very sensitive system. And that system is an absolute gift when it comes to the work that I do, because it allows me to connect with people. It allows me to really go into the art of medicine so much deeper, not just the science, because I feel it's almost like there's a tangible feel of the cases that I'm working on. It's not just the facts and figures that are on the Google Doc or whatever it is. There's a feeling to each case, and that wouldn't necessarily always be felt by somebody who's not as sensitive as me. So there's like this absolute gift of having this sensitivity, which makes me very excellent at what I do. And because of that sensitivity, my body just needs so much more rest and space and nourishment and care. And how do you find the balance in a world that isn't geared up for sensitive systems? You know, there's got to be, you've got to have very, very strong boundaries and a lot of discipline with yourself as well. So this is the landscape that I am constantly navigating. And I think I've gone completely off topic, but hopefully that was a little bit interesting, especially for those of you who maybe feel like you're coming up against something similar in your own journeys in terms of your sensitivity. Hopefully that was an insightful share as well. But where I'd like to go next, because I think it kind of piggybacks off this conversation of capacity, is another question. Again, this was two questions I've kind of blended together, one that came through the Instagram Q&A and then another one that came through just a message, which was, how do we deal with new infections and symptoms when you're already on a fatigue journey? So this is like you've got some sort of syndromal illness, chronic fatigue, shall we say, and then you get a viral infection or you get a cold or you get some sort of acute infection. And then it can be very distressing to now have these new symptoms, even though, you know, cognitively and, you know, consciously, you know, that they're temporary. And then additionally, I think with you knowing that a lot of people have had long COVID, especially if your initial illness was triggered by a COVID infection, maybe getting reinfected can be a very scary thing as well. And so how do we deal with all of that? And I think this is where I feel that a huge part of this comes back to the capacity to be able to manage big sensations in the body and also big emotions in the body. And I realized I didn't actually address the second part of the first question, which was, how do you build capacity to be with sensations instead of fleeing them? Well, it's exactly the same, is that if we can't really be in our bodies very much, we need to work on stability, we need to build coherence, and then we need to titrate exposure to sensations within the body. So let's bring that into this next question. First of all, we have to build the ability to tolerate our symptoms without distress. So I know a lot of people teach different things when it comes to the nervous system. And some people say, you know, don't symptom scan, don't fixate on your symptoms. And I think that can be helpful at times. We don't want to overwhelm ourselves by feeling our symptoms all the time. We all need healthy levels of distraction and just a break from being in the body sometimes, especially if you're unwell. But we also want to have the capacity to feel ourselves, the good sensations, as well as the unpleasant symptoms. And so we need to practice both. One of the things I would do in my own journey was I did a lot of yin yoga. And I just think yin yoga, obviously, you know, different things work for different people. But for me, because the whole point of yin yoga is to put yourself into an uncomfortable position where you're not in complete distress, a comfortable position which feels manageable, and hold and support and be with yourself in the discomfort. So I would apply those principles of yin yoga to symptoms. Sometimes I wouldn't even practice the yin yoga. I just put on the yin yoga playlist. I just go lie down on the bed and I would just practice being with my symptoms, being with the discomfort of my symptoms. And just to go back to the previous conversation, we still need to stabilize. We still need to have the coherence, because just to do that for some people could be very overwhelming. And I'm not saying you should just throw yourself into doing this. But when you have enough capacity to be with your symptoms, you can be alongside them without them creating additional distress. And so when there is panic or fear, or sometimes even anger and frustration at a new infection or a new symptom, even if it's only going to be temporary, part of dealing with that is having the nervous system capacity to be with the symptoms and to also be with the big emotions, the emotion of fear, the emotion of anger, the emotion of frustration, being with panic. So this is actually our capacity to deal with these acute infections comes back down to our ability to support ourselves from a nervous system perspective. Because if we could move some of that fear to trust, or we could just accept this is happening now, but it's not going to be like this forever. This is just an acute infection. In 7 to 10 days, I'll probably be feeling different again. And just surrender to the process. That in itself is going to create a softening in the body, which could potentially be very supportive. I don't want to dismiss the fact that if you had COVID and that was a trigger for long COVID for you, and now you're experiencing a secondary, another COVID infection, that could be a very scary thing, because your body has a memory of, I was fine, then I had this infection, and then I was never the same again. And now I've got another infection. What's going to happen after this? And so here there's two parts, I would say. There's the part that I've already spoken about, which is doing the nervous system work to support your body through the fear. Because if we are able to turn some of that fear into trust, into acceptance, into surrender, the outcome is probably only going to be exactly the same, if not more positive. And then there is this other thing, which is if you were someone who was well and then you had a viral infection and you've never been the same since, no doubt in that time, you've learned so much more about caring for yourself. And even though your health isn't necessarily where you want it to be, you are so much more better informed, better equipped, and knowledgeable about your body and health in general, that you have more tools than you have ever had in your entire life to weather the storm, so to speak. And so even if your health isn't exactly where you want to be, there's almost a case of trusting that the damage has already been done. Yes, there may be some like temporary damage from an infection now, but you're also probably caring for yourself better now than you have done in the past. And that may help with a more speedy recover and repair. And if a secondary infection does cause a little bit of a setback or a relapse or a flare, then it's also just knowing and trusting that you have the tools to get back to where you are now. The only thing you're going to lose is a little bit of time. And of course, nobody wants to lose time. Everybody wants to gain time and more life and just have their health back. But I think it's if we can just meet ourselves where we are and move forward from a place of acceptance and trust, we'll probably make the journey so much more easier on ourselves. And so that's how I would like to answer that question. The next question goes into a little bit more practical stuff, which is what should we do if despite sleeping, we wake feeling unrefreshed? And two people asked this question. So this is why one of the reasons why I pulled this one out to answer today. And I think this is really common. This was definitely an experience for me in my own journey where every morning I would wake up with kind of like a brain fog and that sort of cloud behind my eyes. And, you know, it's like every single morning you're waking up and you're just wondering, you know, am I going to feel like that? Or is it going to be better? Or is it going to be worse? You know, because they're varying degrees of how it may feel. And then say, the things to kind of think about here were one of the things I noticed in my journey was that blood sugar regulation was a really important thing for me. And if my blood sugar was stable, I would generally feel better. And so if I ate something that I perhaps shouldn't have eaten the night before, I would wake up in the morning with more of that hangover feeling. So I realized that, you know, if you're going to cheat on your diet, not that I would think of it as cheating, but if you're going to be more flexible with your diet, shall we say, that needs to happen at lunchtime versus in the evening. Evening meals need to be spot on. Evening meals need to support optimal blood sugar control because that contributes to the morning feeling. And so many of my clients report the same. So making sure that as a whole across the board, your blood sugar is fully optimized would be a step to consider. And then definitely your evening meal should support optimal blood sugar control. So if, I mean, not to say that you can't have a meal which doesn't support optimal blood sugar control, but then you need to be prepared to suffer the consequences of that the next morning. The other thing to consider would be a poor cortisol awakening response. So cortisol awakening response is the surge in cortisol that should happen within 30 minutes to an hour of waking. And this is what I would describe as your get up and go to start the day. Your cortisol levels are generally low overnight. They kind of start creeping up from about 2 a.m. And then after you wake in the morning, if you have a healthy biorhythm and a healthy body clock, they should surge. And that's like the punch, I call it. It's like, okay, let's go. We're ready. Now, if people don't have a cortisol awakening response or they have a suboptimal cortisol awakening response, they may not get that get up and go to start the day, that kind of like I'm ready for the day feeling. And in which case we need to think about what the adrenal glands need. Now, in most cases where I've seen the worst cortisol awakening response, it's been when people haven't been disciplined enough to observe a healthy biorhythm and to facilitate good circadian rhythms through healthy routines, morning waking at the same time each day, going to bed at the same time each night, even if you don't sleep, still, you know, practicing that unwind routine, reducing bright light exposure, getting to bed at a decent time, the same time, making sure even if you're not sleeping, you're not exposing yourself to screens and blue light through the night, and then getting up at the same time each day. So that would be the first thing to consider if you're struggling with your morning waking is, have I got a consistent routine of going to bed on time and waking up at the same time each day? And then the next step is getting light exposure within 30 minutes of waking. So that's ideally light on your eyes, not through sunglasses, glasses, or a window, within 30 minutes of waking. I think it's 3 minutes on a sunny day, 10 minutes on a partly cloudy day, and then 20 to 30 minutes on a cloudier day. So unfortunately, if the weather's bad, you have to spend more time outside, which is counterintuitive, but it has to be done. If you wake up in the northern hemisphere when it's still dark, like I do, just get as much bright light as possible. And then once the sun does come up, if you can get some natural light on your eyes, that's ideal. So those would be the first things. And then getting a little bit more advanced, because these things will require a bit more capacity from the individual, morning movement. So if you are able to do just 10 minutes of exercise within 10 minutes of waking, that would be ideal. The higher intensity, the better, but obviously being mindful of your capacity. You can do cold showers. So I've spoken about this on a previous podcast. My summer routine is wake up, walk down to the beach, do a cold plunge, you know, with the morning light on my eyes, loads of stuff going on there, which is supportive of a healthy circadian rhythm and a healthy cortisol awakening response. And then finally, if you're working with a practitioner, you could consider something like licorice root to prevent the breakdown of cortisol in the morning. I use that a lot with my clients. And then general sort of adrenal support and nervous system support as well across the day. So we've got blood sugar supporting cortisol awakening response. And then there's just a few other things you might want to consider, which is toxic load. At nighttime, that's when the body is doing a lot of its detoxification. In the daytime, your body is kind of functioning and it's busying itself with activities of daily living. But then at nighttime, the immune system is more active. We're detoxing. We're doing a lot of this sort of cleanup and housekeeping. And if you've got a high toxic load and you're sleeping stagnant all night, then there may be a need to sort of get up and get things moving again. So I know sometimes when I've felt really groggy, doing some lymphatic drainage, just dry brushing in the morning, and then some movement really helps with mental clarity and alertness. But the bigger picture is obviously thinking about, well, what is causing this toxic load? Is there a mold issue? Is there just a bacterial dysbiosis in the gut, which is contributing to toxin overload? Are you just generally exposed to lots of toxins through food and water and your environment? Do you have regular bowel movements? Are you sweating? you know, how is the liver working? So all of these things as well would contribute to the overall sort of sense of alertness in the morning. So those are all considerations, and I guess you just have to take what you can from that and make some choices in terms of how you support yourself. I always recommend not adding in too many things at once. So pick one thing. Maybe it's blood sugar. Maybe it's some of the adrenal support stuff. Maybe it's some of the toxic load support stuff. Pick just one thing, work on it, master it, know that you've optimized that aspect, and then move on to the next. Not every single thing is going to necessarily produce noticeable results, but think of it as like laying the bricks of the foundations for a house. You can't build the house until you've laid the foundations, but sometimes, you know, just laying down the foundations doesn't necessarily build the house. So you may do some work which isn't noticeable in terms of your goals, but it's going to create a strong foundation for the work that comes later. And then linking it back to that idea of stabilizing the body being the first step. Some of these things are really important for stability, like working on blood sugar, like working on routine, like optimizing circadian rhythms. The next question I had was tips on preparing for an operation. I'm worried it will make me crash. So this is a very interesting one to talk about. It's an area that I find fascinating. I've shared a little bit in one of the previous episodes about some of my own experiences with the nervous system and medical trauma or surgical trauma. And you can always go back and listen to that episode. Would love to tell you which one it is, but I can't remember. But it would have been one of the more kind of nervous system brain retraining type of episodes. And first of all, I guess just to say that surgeries can be traumatic for the body. You know, even though you may consciously know that electing to have a surgical procedure where you go under general anesthetic is in your best interests. You know, maybe you need to have an appendix removed, or maybe you need to have a laparoscopy, or maybe you need to have some sort of other procedure. And that making the decision, for example, to have your appendix removed is life-saving. You need to do that. And logically, you know, it's in your best interests for survival to do that. But to what I would call the animal body, the part of you that isn't the conscious and rational mind, what happens is you get drugged and then somebody attacks you with a knife in your sleep. And so that's a very crude way of expressing it, but that's essentially what's happening, is you're attacked in your sleep to the unconscious mind. So that could then seem very frightening, especially if you're listening to this and you do have a surgical procedure coming up and you're thinking, I don't want to be attacked in my sleep. But just remember that challenging things happen to people all the time. And I like to believe that human beings are incredibly resilient. And therefore, it's not about what happens to us, but it's about how we create the space to support ourselves around what happens to us. And that's exactly the approach that we want to apply to surgery preparation. When I did my intermediate year of somatic experiencing, we did a piece on medical trauma, and we actually did a piece on surgery pre and post support. And a big part of it is just making sure that you have the support that you need. So there may be just questions that you need to ask yourself, like, who do you want to be there with you when you go to the hospital? Who do you want to be there with you when you wake up? Who do you not want to be there with you when you go to the hospital? Who do you not want to be there when you wake up? Like, who's going to take care of your cats, for example? Who's going to take care of your kids? Do you trust those people to do a good job? Do you need to take time off work? How much time do you need? How can you give yourself more time than what you think you need? The big thing is that sometimes people will have these medical procedures and they just get straight back into life because they have to. But if there's anything that you can do to create a lot of cushioning and support and allowing for your body to recalibrate after the operation that can be really supportive. I've got a client I'm working with at the moment whose chronic fatigue was triggered after general anesthetic. And we've kind of like established that her system is just really, 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 really frozen as a consequence of that. And so I know what she's finding helpful at the moment is a lot of craniosacral therapy. But for others, it could be massage. It could be doing some one-on-one somatic experiencing. It could be something else completely different. So what do you think that your nervous system needs to support you pre and post surgery? Could you do some somatic work around the fear of the surgery? And then after the surgery has happened, could you do some more somatic work just to help clear maybe any kind of survival or defensive responses that are stuck in the body? So just because we know we've got to go through something that's challenging doesn't mean that it has to be a disaster and cause of a flare and cause of a relapse. If we can be prepared and mindful and thoughtful and conscientious and conscious, we can choose to put things in place that will allow for the greatest amount of support. And then this actually could be a capacity building experience versus something that would set you back or cause a crash. So that's just some food for thought. And it doesn't have to be a general anesthetic. It could even be a procedure with local anesthetic. It could even be a trip to your dentist. What does your body need before? What does your body need afterwards? And how can you give yourself as much space and support so that whatever needs to be done can happen and you can feel supported and safe in your nervous system. So then the final question, this one came through the website, so it's a little bit longer, but it's on medications. And I'll just read out the question here. It says, you don't really mention medications on your podcast. Do most of your patients take medications? Do they find them helpful or actually part of the problem? Do many of them come off medications after treatment for their underlying conditions? I've often felt the medications my doctors have given me make things worse rather than better. I'm slowly tapering off one of my medications, but I'm curious about your patients' experience with drugs normally given to people with fatigue and pain disorders, for example, antidepressants and anticonvulsants, etc. So I'll start by saying one of the reasons why I don't speak about medications on this podcast, or if I do, I probably speak about them very, very little, is because to a certain extent, they're beyond my scope of practice. I'm not a doctor. I'm a nutritional therapist. I have a master's in personalized nutrition, and I'm a fully certified functional medicine practitioner, but that doesn't make me a medical doctor. So when it comes to medications, I cannot prescribe medications. It's not my place to tell clients to stop medications, and it's not my place to tell clients how to taper off medications. All of that is reserved for their doctor. But what I can do is I can support clients alongside their medications. So we have, whenever we take on a new client, we have a section on their intake form where they tell us what medications they're on. And the first thing we'll do is we'll first of all go and check if any of those medications are interacting with each other. We'll also check if those medications are interacting with any supplements they might be taking. And we'll also check for nutrient depletions. So some medications will also deplete certain nutrients. So a classic one is, for example, metformin can deplete B12. Statins can deplete coenzyme Q10. The oral contraceptive pill can deplete vitamin B6 and zinc. So there's a lot of depletions that can happen when someone is on a medication. And so what I think sometimes happens is that often medications are prescribed with the client's best interests at heart, but there's not always an awareness of the nutrient depletions. And there's not always an awareness of how these things interact with each other and supplements. So that's something that we always check. In terms of my client base, we have clients that are on no medications, and we have clients that are on multiple medications. We have a screening process. So when somebody applies to work with us, this is like an initial application form for a preliminary call. We ask them how many medications they're on. And this can sometimes be a little bit of a red flag, because when someone is on a lot of medications, it can suggest one of two things. First of all, the person is not really interested in what we offer, which is the lifestyle medicine piece. And they're just more happy to just take loads and loads of medications, kind of like a pill for an ill. That person's not necessarily going to be a candidate for working with us. But the other thing is sometimes the person's just been prescribed loads and loads of medications, which they're willingly taking because it's what their doctor has told them to do, and they're trying to be a good patient. But they are actually interested in coming off of them longer term. And then we can collaborate with doctors to support that. I always ask clients when they're taking certain medications, I was like, oh, you know, would you be interested in coming off of this or that? And a lot of them will say yes. A lot of them have a preference to be on less medications, just because of the interactions, just because of the side effects, just because of the nutrient depletions. And in some cases, yes, they can make things worse rather than better. Things that our clients often take, LDN, low-dose naltrexone, very popular in the chronic illness, chronic fatigue community. That's probably the one that comes up the most. I do sometimes get asked, should I be taking low-dose naltrexone? And what I would say is that some of my clients who take it really like, yes, when I started taking that, it helped me so much. And then others are like, I didn't really notice a difference. So like most things, people need to try and see. I did actually have another question recently about what are my thoughts on beta blockers in terms of getting people out of the fight or flight response. And again, I have seen clients successfully use beta blockers just to get their system a little bit more stabilized. You know, when you've got a chronic illness and you're coming up against all these challenges, sometimes we just need to take a few quick wins. And if that means taking an antihistamine or taking a beta blocker or an antidepressant, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you take something that just helps a little bit so that you can then work on the lifestyle factors to get a little bit more stable? So I would say that those are probably the most common ones, the LDN, the beta blockers, antidepressants, and antihistamines. Haven't really worked with many people with anticonvulsants. I have worked with, like, this is an example of what can be really challenging, is when someone's taking something to boost their energy in the morning and then taking something to suppress their energy in the evening so they can sleep, and they're just constantly on the kind of like uppers and downers. That is a very, very challenging situation to get someone out of. And in which case, you know, they're just constantly on this artificial roller coaster ride due to the medication. When I have worked with clients on multiple more psychiatric medications, they've usually been under the care of a psychiatrist who's working on the tapering with them. And I think that's really important, to have an appropriately trained healthcare professional to work on any tapering. But I'd say every case is different. Whenever I'm like interviewing new clients, or new clients are interviewing me, they're always asking, well, what do your other clients do about this? Or what would you say is this? And I'm like, you know what? It's just so hard to say, because every case is so different. And that's what I love about this work as well, because it doesn't get boring, because you've got the variety in the types of people that you're working with, and then you've got the variety in the types of mechanisms that you're working with, and then how the people are responding to those mechanisms. And it's always juicy and interesting and different. So that was probably not a very specific answer, because it's really hard for me to give a specific answer about this question. But I would say, if I was to be a bit more general, I would say medications seem to really help in the short term. And if we can get the body stable enough and well enough and balanced enough, then we can have a conversation with the prescribing doctor about tapering and reducing medications. And many people have a lot of success with that as well. So that brings me to the end of today's episode. Thank you so much to everybody who submitted these questions, whether you knew you were doing it or not. And I will see you soon in the next episode.